Thus have I heard on one occasion the Blessed One was wandering in the country of the Vidayans with a large sangha of monks. He didn't travel anywhere without 500 monks following him. That's the way it says it in the suttas anyway. He might have had 20, but they always give him the 500. Now on that occasion, the Brahmin Brahmayu was living at Mithila. He was old, aged, burdened with years, advanced in life, and came to the last stage, his last stage. He was 120 years old. He was a master in the three Vedas with their vocabulary, liturgy, phonology and etymology, and histories as the fifth. Still skilled in philology and grammar, he was fully versed in the natural philosophy and the marks of a great man. The Brahmin Brahmayu heard the recluse Gotama, the son of the Sakyans, who went forth from the Sakyan clan, has been wandering in the country of the Vidayans with a large sangha of monks. Now, a good report of Master Gotama has been spread to this effect. The Blessed One is accomplished, fully awakened, perfect in true knowledge and conduct, sublime knower of the worlds, incomparable leader of persons to be tamed, teacher of gods and humans, awakened and blessed. This is the good qualities of the Buddha that I was talking about with him yesterday. He declares this world with its gods, its maras, and its brahmins, this generation with its recluses and brahmins, with its princes and its people, which he has himself realized with direct knowledge. He teaches the Dhamma that is good in the beginning, good in the middle, and good in the end, with the right meaning and phrasing. And he reveals a holy life that is utterly perfect and pure. Now, it is good to see such arahats. Now, at that time, the Brahmin Brahmayu had a young Brahmin student named Uttara, who was a master in the three Vedas, fully versed in the natural philosophy and marks of a great man. He told his student, "My dear Uttara, the recluse Gotama, son of the Sakyans, who went forth from the Sakyan clan, has been wandering in the country of the Vidayans with a large sangha of monks." Now, it's good to see such arahats. Come, my dear Uttara, go to the recluse Gotama and find out whether the report spread about him is true or not, and whether Master Gotama is one such as this or not. Thus we shall know about Master Gotama through you. But how shall I find out, sir, whether the report spread about Master Gotama is true or not, and whether Master Gotama is one such as this or not? My dear Uttara, the 32 marks of a great man have been handed down in our hymns. And the great man who is endowed with them has only two possible destinies, no other. If he lives the home life, he becomes a wheel-turning monarch, a righteous king who rules by Dhamma, master of the four quarters, victorious, who has stabilized his country and possesses seven treasures. He has these seven treasures, the wheel treasure, the elephant treasure, the horse treasure, the jewel treasure, the women treasure, the steward treasure, and the counselor treasure as the seventh. His children, who exceed 1,000, he's a busy young man, are brave and heroic and crush the armies of others over the earth bounded by the oceans. He rules without a rod, without a weapon, by means of the Dhamma. But he goes forth from the home life into homelessness. He becomes an accomplished one, a fully awakened one, who draws aside the veil to in the world. But I, my dear Uttara, am the giver of hymns. You are the receiver of them. Yes, sir, he replied. He rose from his seat after paying homage to the Brahmin Brahmayu, keeping him on the right. He left for the country of the Vidayans, where the Blessed One was wandering. Traveling by stages, he came to the Blessed One and exchanged greetings with him. When this courteous and amiable talk was finished, he sat down at one side and looked for the 32 marks of a great man on the Blessed One's body. He saw more or less the 32 marks of a great man on the Blessed One's body, except two. He was doubtful and uncertain about these two marks. He could not decide and make up his mind about them, about the male organ being enclosed in a sheath. This is like a bull, enclosed with the sheath. And about largeness of the tongue. Then it occurred to the Blessed One, the Brahmin student, Uttara, sees more or less the 32 marks of a great man on me, except two. He's doubtful and uncertain about the two. He cannot decide and make up his mind about them, about a male organ being enclosed in a sheath, and about the largeness of the tongue. Then the Blessed One worked such a feat of supernormal power that the Brahmin Brahmayu, that the Brahmin student Uttara saw that the Blessed One's male organ was enclosed with a sheath. Next, the Blessed One extruded his tongue, and he repeatedly touched both ear holes and both nostrils, and he covered the whole of his forehead with his tongue. That's a big tongue. Then the Brahmin student Uttara thought, the recluse Gotama is endowed with the 32 marks of a great man. Suppose I were to follow the recluse Gotama and observe his behavior. Then he followed the Blessed One for 7 months, like a shadow never leaving him. At the end of 7 months, in the country of the Vidayans, he set out to journey to Mathila, where the Brahmin Brahmayu was. When he arrived, he paid homage to him, sat down at one side. Thereupon, the Brahmin Brahmayu asked him, my dear Uttara, is the report that has been spread about Master Gotama true or not? And is Master Gotama one such as this and not or not? The report that has been spread about Master Gotama is true, sir, and not otherwise. And Master Gotama is one such as this and not otherwise. He possesses the 32 marks of a great man. Master Gotama sets his foot down evenly, squarely. He doesn't heel and toe. He walks. This is a mark of the great man in Master Gotama. On the soles of his feet there are wheels with 1,000 spokes and ribs and hubs, all complete. He has projecting heels. Most people, their heel goes straight down, but his came back a little bit. He has long fingers and toes. His hands and feet are soft and tender. He has netted hands and feet. That means this part of the finger came up to the first joint. His feet are arched. He has legs like an antelope. That means skinny calves. When he stands without stooping, the palms of both of his hands touch and rub against his knees. Now that's long arms. Generally speaking, when you stretch your arms out like this, you're as wide as you are tall. I'm a little bit over that. And I don't even come close to having my palms touch my knees. His male organ is enclosed in a sheath. He is the color of gold. His skin has a golden sheen. He has fine skin. And because of this fineness of his skin, dust and dirt do not stick on his body. I don't know if when you went to Asia, did you notice that your skin becomes very fine because of the humidity and the heat? And when you go into cold areas, then you start seeing more and more roughness. Yeah. His body hairs grow singly, each body hair growing alone in a hair socket. The tips of his body hairs turn up. The upturned body hairs are blue-black, the color of carillium, curled and turned to the right. Now, you see a lot of Buddha images that has a head that it has those curls in it. But that's not actually the way the Buddha's head was. That's the artist. There's a sign that the artist make with some people, and they put those little knots on their head because that is talking about the openness of the pineal gland. And the pineal gland is considered the gland of awakening. So they do that. In India, they don't do that. They have his hair just like regular hair. He has the straight limbs of a Brahma. He has 7 convexities. I forget what those are. The number is so small I can't hardly see it. 855 maybe. The seven are the backs of the four limbs, two shoulders and trunk, convexities. It might be, I don't know. See, this sutta was explained to me 20 years ago, and I never heard of it before. And there's the Sri Lankans, their version, and there is the Burmese version. And I go more with the Burmese version than the Sri Lankan version. And I'll show you why in just a minute. He has the torso of a lion. That means he has a big chest. The furrow between his shoulders is filled in. Now, where's the convexities in the back? Yeah. He has the spread of a banyan tree. The span of his arms equals his height. Now, that's impossible. If he stands and his palms touch his, he's much bigger this way than he is tall. This is the Sri Lankan explanation of it. The Burmese, they say that he was well proportioned, and that's as far as they go with it. He would be kind of a freak to have his arms being that long. His neck and shoulders are even. His taste is supremely acute. He is lion-jawed, which means he had kind of a square jaw. He has 40 teeth. Everybody else has 32. So he has two extra teeth at top and bottom on both sides. His teeth are even. His teeth are without gaps. His teeth are quite white. He has a large tongue. He has a divine voice like the call of the Karvika bird. In Asia, there's this little tiny yellow bird that has a real big voice, and it's beautiful. And when you hear it, you stop and listen to him. And that's what the Buddha's voice was like. He has dark blue eyes. Now, in Asia, that's unheard of. Everybody has brown or black eyes. But he was a deep blue. Yeah. But he was a Sakyan. And that's why he had golden skin instead of the browner colored skin. So. He has eyelashes like an oxen. So he had real long eyelashes. He has hair growing in the space between his eyebrows. Now the Buddha images, they almost always have a little dot there or something like that. This hair was white. And if he pulled it out, it was about 2 feet long. And it was soft like cotton. His head is shaped like a turban, This is a mark of a great man. And this does happen with people that do meditate, is you start getting like a little lump on your head. When I started meditating, my head was very round. As I was meditating more and more, I started growing this little thing. And now they're starting to tell you that your brain actually grows when you do meditation. The more you practice being grateful, sending loving kindness, that sort of thing, your brain actually does grow, and it becomes a little misshapen. Master Gotama is endowed with these 32 marks of a great man. When he walks, he steps out with his right foot first, always. I tried that for a while. It's a hard practice, because you forget about it. He does not extend his foot too far or put it down too near. He walks neither too quickly nor too slowly. He walks without his knees knocking together. He walks without his ankles knocking together. He walks without raising or lowering his thighs, or bringing them together or keeping them apart. He walks only with the lower part of his body oscillates. He does not walk with bodily effort. When he turns to look, he does so with his whole body, so he doesn't look over his shoulder. He does not look straight up. He does not look straight down. He does not walk looking about. He looks a plow's yoke length before him. Beyond that, he has unhindered knowledge and vision. When he goes indoors, he does not raise or lower his body, or bend it forward or back. Now, in the Vinaya, there's a lot of speculation as to how tall he was. Some people say that he was 14 feet tall. But when you look at some of the old buildings and the ruins, they didn't have that it was more like what we have right now. So he was big. He was tall. He's a little taller than I am. But I consider him to be about two meters tall. But even that, most doors are, that's real close. So it says that he doesn't bow his head to walk through the doorway, but that's getting very close. He turns round neither too far from the seat nor too near. He does not lean on the seat with his hands. He does not throw his body onto the seat. When seated indoors, he does not fidget with his hands. He does not fidget with his feet. He does not sit with his knees crossed. He does not sit with his ankles crossed. He does not sit with his hand holding his chin. When seated indoors, he is not afraid. He does not shiver and tremble. He is not nervous. being unafraid, not shivering or trembling or nervous. His hair does not stand up, and he is intent on seclusion. When he receives the water for the bowl, he does not raise or lower the bowl or tip it forward or backwards. The tradition in Sri Lanka for monks is you always put water in a bowl and rinse it out and pour it out, and then you put food in. He receives neither too little nor too much water for the bowl. He washes the bowl without making splashing sounds. He washes the bowl without turning it around. And this is something you see all the monks doing. He does not put the bowl on the floor to wash his hands. When his hands are washed, the bowl is washed. When the bowl is washed, his hands are washed. He pours the water from the bowl neither too far nor too near, and he does not pour it about. When he receives rice, he does not raise or lower the bowl or tip it forwards or backwards. Now, this is when he's sitting. But sometimes, when I was going out on alms round, there were little kids that wanted to put something in the bowl, so I had to bend down and point it towards them so they could get it in the bowl. He receives neither too little rice nor too much rice. When I was going on alms round, I didn't have a choice. I accepted whatever they gave. I always came back with enough food for 5 other people. He adds sauce in the right proportion. He does not exceed the right amount of sauce in a mouthful. He turns the mouthful over 2 or 3 times in his mouth and then swallows it. And no rice kernel enters his body unchewed. Well, no, it's pretty good. That means turning it over with his tongue. That doesn't mean just turning it over so he can chew one time. So he's chewing it, and then he's. No rice kernel remains in his mouth. When he takes another mouthful, he takes the food experiencing the taste, though not experiencing greed for the taste. And that's a good thing, because some of the stuff they taste, and some of it's great. You were in India. Did you eat bitter gourd? Yeah, that was one of the tastes that it really did not agree with me.
I agree.
Right. But people that live there, they love it. I don't understand. The food he takes has 8 factors. It is neither for amusement, nor for intoxication, nor for the sake of physical beauty and attractiveness, but only for the endurance and continuance of his body, for the ending of discomfort, being hungry, and for assisting in the holy life. He considers thus, I shall terminate old feelings without arousing new feelings, and I shall be healthy and blameless and shall live in comfort. Now, I only eat one meal a day. I found out if I eat a breakfast that I'm not hungry for lunch, and then I'm hungry for the rest of the day. I went to Australia, and it was winter there. And I was only taking one meal a day. I never caught a cold. But then it started to be springtime. And I started going where the monks were eating breakfast, and I would take a little bit of that and a little bit of this. Before long, I was eating two meals a day, and I immediately caught a cold. So I went back to one meal a day, the cold goes away. They're especially for laymen, they eat too many times a day for good health. And there's always, well, breakfast is the most important meal of the day. No, it's not. Lunch is. If you eat in the evening, you have a tendency to eat really choice food, and you have a tendency to get fat, because you eat, then you go to bed. So it's better not to do that. When he has eaten and receives water for the bowl, he does not raise or lower the bowl or tip it forwards or backwards. This is when he's cleaning his bowl. He receives neither too little nor too much water for the bowl. He washes the bowl without making any splashing noises. He washes the bowl without turning it around. He does not put his bowl on the floor to wash his hands. When his hands are washed, the bowl is washed. When the bowl is washed, his hands are washed. He pours the water out for the bowl, neither too far nor too near. And he does not pour it about. Now, quite often, monks will eat in the same room together, but when they get ready to clean their bowl, they take the bowl and take it into the room or bathroom and wash it there. Taking the little bits of food and oil and that kind of stuff, you can't pour it on living plants. That's one of the rules. It's not one of the big rules, but it is a dukkata. When he's eaten, he puts the bowl on the floor, neither too far nor too near. This is when he's eating, mostly when he's eating at somebody else's house. So he'll put the bowl down out of the way so nobody's going to kick it, but carefully. And he is neither careless of the bowl nor overly solicitous about it. When he has eaten, he sits in silence for a while. You notice that I don't get up right away after I'm done eating. But he does not let the time for the blessing go by. He always gave a Dhamma talk after eating. When he has eaten and gives the blessing, he does not do so criticizing the meal or expecting another meal. He instructs, urges, rouses, and gladdens that audience with a talk purely on the Dhamma. When he has done so, he raises from his seat and departs. He walks neither too fast nor too slow, and he does not go as one who wants to get away. His robe is worn neither too high nor too low. And that's Burmese wear the robe so that the inner robe, the under robe, is one hand longer than the outer robe. And the tie are just the opposite. So there's a cultural stuff in that. His robe is not too tight against his body, nor too loose on his body. Nor does the wind blow his robe around from his body. On our robes we have little strings like that, and we have some buttons that we can tie them together if we want to, and that stops our robes from flying around. Dust and dirt do not soil his body. I wonder how he went out on alms round without having that happen. When he is gone to the monastery, he sits down on a seat made ready. Having sat down, he washes his feet, though he does not concern himself with grooming his feet. He was walking around barefoot all the time. So a lot of times you'll hear in the suttas that before he gets to a place to give a Dhamma talk, that he'll wash his feet first. Having washed his feet, he sits down cross-legged. And this is maybe he did sometimes and maybe he didn't. And establishes mindfulness in front of him. He does not occupy his mind with self-affliction, or the affliction of others, or the affliction of both. He sits with his mind set on his own welfare, on the welfare of others, and on the welfare of both, even on the welfare for the whole world. When he has gone to the monastery, he teaches the Dhamma to an audience. He neither flatters nor berates that audience. He instructs, urges, rouses, and encourages it with talks purely on the Dhamma. The speech that issues from his mouth has eight qualities. It's distinct, intelligible, melodious, audible, ringing, euphorious, deep, and sonorous. But while his voice is intelligible, as far as the audience expands, his speech does not issue out beyond the audience. So if you're walking by, you won't hear him. When the people have been instructed, urged, roused, and gladdened by him, they rise from their seats and depart, looking only at him and concerned with nothing else. Quite often, somebody will give a Dhamma talk and they'll see, it says that they always keep him on their right. This is not necessarily true. The Asians and Middle Easterns, when they go to the toilet, they clean themselves with their left hand. And that's considered a dirty hand. So that would be disrespectful if that's what your thing is. But it's right attitude more than on the right side. We have seen Master Gotama walking, sir. We have seen him standing. We have seen him entering indoors. We have seen him indoors seated in silence. We have seen him eating indoors. We have seen him seated in silence after eating. We have seen him giving up the blessing after eating. We have seen him going to the monastery. We have seen him in the monastery, seated in silence. We have seen him in the monastery, teaching the Dhamma to an audience. Such is the Master Gotama. Such he is, and more than that. When this was said, the Brahmin Brahmayu rose from his seat. After arranging his upper robe on one shoulder, he extended his hands in reverential salutation towards the Blessed One and uttered the exclamation three times, "Honor to the Blessed One, accomplished and fully awakened. Honor to the Blessed One, accomplished and fully awakened. Honored to the Blessed One, accomplished and fully awakened. Perhaps sometime or other, we might meet Master Gotama. Perhaps we might have some conversation with him." And then in the course of his wandering, the Blessed One arrived at Mathila. There the Blessed One lived in a... Makhadeva's mango grove. The Brahmin householders of Mathila heard the recluse Gotama, the son of the Sakyans, who went forth from the Sakyan clan, has been wandering in the country of the Vidayans with a large sangha of monks. And he has now come to Mathila and is living in this mango grove. Now, a good report of Master Gotama has been spread to this effect. And it is good to see such arahats. Then the Brahmin householders of Mathila went to the Blessed One. Some paid homage to the Blessed One and sat down at one side. Paying homage generally means bowing. Some exchange greetings with him without bowing. And when this courteous and amiable talk was finished, sat down at one side. "How are you? Are you in good health? Are you getting enough food?" That kind of thing. Some extended their hands in reverential salutation towards him and sat down at one side. So they just... In Thailand, they are bowing machines. And a week after I had become a monk, I was at this monastery, and the king came to the monastery. And he bowed to me. And then he started talking to me in English because he'd lived in America for a while. And I had so many problems after that with jealous monks that I had to leave the monastery. That happens. Some extended their... Oh, I already did that. Some pronounced the name and clan in the Blessed One's presence and sat down at one side. Some kept silent and sat down at one side. So it's not always having to bow. The Brahmin Brahmayu heard the recluse Gotama, the son of the Sakyans, who went forth from the Sakyan clan, has arrived at Mathila and is living in a mango grove in Mathila. Then the Brahmin Brahmayu went to the mango grove with a number of Brahmin students. When he came to the mango grove, he thought, it is not proper that I should go to the recluse Gotama without being announced. Then he addressed a certain Brahmin student. Come, Brahmin student, go to the recluse Gotama and ask in my name whether the recluse Gotama is free from illness and affliction, and is healthy and strong and abiding in comfort. Saying, Master Gotama, the Brahmin Brahmayu ask whether Master Gotama is free from illness and is abiding in comfort. And say this, the Brahmin Brahmayu, Master Gotama, is old, aged, burdened with years, advanced in life and come to the last stage. He is in his 120th year. He is a master of the three Vedas with their vocabularies, liturgy, phonology, and etymology, and the histories as the fifth. Skilled in philology and grammar, he is fully versed in the natural philosophy and in the marks of a great man. Of all the Brahmin householders who live in Mithila, the Brahmin Brahmayu is pronounced the foremost of them in wealth, in knowledge of the hymns, and in age and fame. He wants to see Master Gotama. Yes, sir, the Brahmin student replied, and he went to the Blessed One and exchanged greetings with him. And when this courteous and amiable talk was finished, he stood at one side and delivered his message to the Blessed One. The Blessed One said, student, let the Brahmin Brahmayu come at his own convenience. Then the Brahmin student went to the Brahmin Brahmayu and said, permission has been granted by the recluse Gotama. You may come, sir, at your own convenience. So the Brahmin Brahmayu went to the Blessed One. The assembly saw him in the distance, and they at once made way for him as for one who is well known and famous. Then the Brahmin Brahmayu said to the assembly, enough, sirs. Let each sit down on his own seat made ready. They got up and they made a passage so he could get through. Then he's telling them, okay, now go sit down. I shall sit here next to the recluse Gotama. Then he went to the Blessed One and exchanged greetings with him. When this courteous and amiable talk was finished, he sat down at one side and looked for the 32 marks of a great man. He saw more or less the 32 marks of a great man on the Blessed One's body, except two. He was doubtful about two of the marks, and he could not decide and make up his mind about them, about the male organ being enclosed in a sheath, and about the largeness of the tongue. When the Brahmin Brahmayu addressed the Blessed One in stanza, the 32 marks I learned, they are the signs of a great man. I still do not see two of these upon your body, Gotama. Is what should be concealed by cloth, hidden in a sheath, greatest of men? Though called by word in a female gender, perhaps your tongue is a manly one. Perhaps your tongue is large as well. According to what we have been taught, please put it out a little bit. And so, O seer, cure our doubt, for welfare in this very life, and happiness in lives to come. And now we crave to ask for leave to ask something that we are aspiring to know. Then it occurred to the Blessed One, this Brahman Brahmayu sees more or less the 32 marks of a great man on me, except two. He's doubtful and uncertain about two marks. He cannot decide and make up his mind about them, about the male organ being enclosed in a sheath, and about the largeness of the tongue. Then the Blessed One works such a feat of supernormal power that the Brahman Brahmayu saw the Blessed One's male organ is enclosed in a sheath. Next, the Blessed One extruded his tongue, and he repeatedly touched both ear holes and both nostrils and covered the whole of his forehead with his tongue. Then the Blessed One spoke these stanzas to reply to the Brahman Brahmayu. The 32 marks you learned are the signs of a great man. All are on my body can be found. So, Brahman, doubt no more on that. What must be known, I have directly known. What must be developed, I have developed. What must be abandoned, I have abandoned. Therefore, Brahman, I am a Buddha. For welfare in this very life, and happiness in lives to come. Since leave is given you, please ask whatever you aspire to know. Then the Brahman Brahmayu thought, permission has been granted by the recluse Gotama, which should I ask him about? Good in this life or good in lives to come? Then he thought, I am skilled in the good in this life, and others too ask me about the good in this life. Why shouldn't I ask him about good in lives to come? Then he addressed the Blessed One in stanzas. How does one become a Brahman? And how does one attain to knowledge? How has one the triple knowledge? And how is one called a holy scholar? How does one become an arahat? That's the question of the year. And how does one attain completeness? How is one a silent sage? And how is one called a Buddha? Then the Blessed One spoke these stanzas in reply. Who knows about his former lives? Sees heaven and states of deprivation, and has arrived at birth's destruction. A sage who knows by direct knowledge, who knows his mind is purified, entirely freed from lust, who has abandoned birth and death, who is complete in the holy life, who has transcended everything, one such as this is called a Buddha. When this was said, the Brahman Brahmayu rose from his seat, and after arranging his upper robe on one shoulder, he prostrated himself with his head at the Blessed One's feet, and he covered the Blessed One's feet with kisses and caressed them with his hands, pronouncing his name. I am the Brahman Brahmayu, Master Gotama. I am the Brahman Brahmayu. this is something that happens fairly often to me. That people, will bow and put their head on my feet. It makes me feel a little uncomfortable when they do that. Those in the assembly wandered and marveled, and they said, "It is wonderful, sir, it is marvelous. What great power and great might the recluse Gotama has, for a well-known and famous Brahmayu to make such a display of humility." Then the Blessed One said to the Brahman Brahmayu, "Enough, Brahman, arise, sit down on your own seat, since your mind has confidence in me." The Brahman Brahmayu rose and sat down on his seat. The Blessed One then gave him a progressive instruction, that is, talk on giving, talk on virtue, talk on the heavens. He explained the danger, degradation, and defilement in sensual pleasures, and the blessings of renunciation. When he knew that the Brahman Brahmayu's mind was ready, receptive, free from hindrances, elated, confident, he expounded to him the teaching special to the Buddhas. Here they're going to talk just about the Four Noble Truths, but as you know, the Four Noble Truths are part of dependent origination. Suffering, its origin, its cessation, and the path. Just as a clean cloth with all marks removed would take dye evenly, so too, while the Brahman Brahmayu sat, the spotless, immaculate vision of the Dhamma arose in him. All that is subject to arising is subject to cessation. Then the Brahman Brahmayu saw the Dhamma and attained the Dhamma and understood the Dhamma, fathomed the Dhamma. He crossed beyond doubt and did away with perplexity, gained intrepidity, and became independent of others in the teacher's dispensation. Then he said to the Blessed One, "Magnificent Master Gotama, magnificent. Master Gotama has made the Dhamma clear in many ways, as though he were turning upright what had been overthrown, revealing what was hidden, showing the way to one who is lost, or holding up a lamp in the dark for those with eyesight to see forms. I go to Master Gotama for refuge and to the Dhamma and the Sangha of monks. From today, let Master Gotama remember me as a lay follower who has gone to him for refuge for life. Let the Blessed One, together with the Sangha of monks, consent to accept tomorrow's meal from me." That's 500 people. The Blessed One consented in silence. Then, knowing that the Blessed One had consented, what he did was he shook his head, yes, okay. The Brahman Brahmayu rose from his seat, and after paying homage to the Blessed One, keeping him on his right, he departed. Then, when the night had ended, the Brahman Brahmayu had good food and various kinds prepared in his residence. And he had the time announced to the Blessed One, "It is time, Master Gotama, the meal is ready." Then, it being morning, the Blessed One dressed and taking his bowl and outer robe, went to the Sangha of monks, to the Brahmin Brahmayu's residence and sat down and went on the seats made ready. Then for a week, with his own hands, the Brahmin Brahmayu served and satisfied the Sangha of monks headed by the Buddha with various kinds of good food. At the end of that week, the Blessed One set out to wander in the country of the Vidayans. Soon after he had gone, the Brahmin Brahmayu died. Then a number of monks went to the Blessed One. After paying homage to him, sat down at one side and said, "Venerable Sir, the Brahmin Brahmayu has died. What is his destination? What is his future course?" "Monks, the Brahmin Brahmayu was wise. He entered into the way of the Dhamma, and he did not trouble me with interpretation of the Dhamma. With the destruction of the five lower fetters, he reappeared spontaneously in the pure abodes, and there will attain final Nibbana, without ever returning from that world." In other words, he became an anagami. That is what the Blessed One said. The monks were satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. So that gives you an idea of not only the 32 marks of a great man, but it gives you an idea of the way that he conducted himself. And for a period of time, I tried always leading with my right foot when I got up. And when I forgot, then I would go back and sit down and then do it purposefully. It's a good practice, but after a period of time, I just didn't do it anymore. I didn't pay attention to it. But there's a lot of different kinds of practices that monks do that most people don't know about. One of the ascetic practices is only eating out of your bowl. Only when somebody else has put something in your bowl can you eat it. Some monks, they only have three robes. They have their inner robe, they have this robe, and they have a double thick robe. And that's all they wear. Now, I had a robe that just gave up the ghost. And it broke my heart. It was falling apart. It was so thin. But I had that same robe for 20 years. And that's the robe I used. It was like having an old pair of Levi's that were just perfect before they start falling apart. That's the way the robe was. And I could just flip it on and it would stay where it was supposed to stay, and it was really good. And then I'd hold it up to the light and you could see right through it. So I had to finally let that one go. But there are other practices that monks do privately. One practice is only using three postures: sitting, walking, standing still. No lying down. One of the old Burmese monks that came to America for quite a while, actually, he started that practice when he was 20. He died when he was 96. So for 76 years, he never laid down. There's three levels of that particular practice. One is sitting out in the middle of the room and sitting in meditation. And there's a lot of monks that try that, but they wind up sleeping, and it winds up hurting their back very badly. The middle way of that practice is leaning against a wall. I did that for about 6 months. That's a good practice. And the other one is sitting in a chair. Now, because I had so many problems with my ankles and legs, I don't sit in meditation anymore. I sit on a chair. So, sitting like that actually gives you more energy. And you wind up taking little cat naps, you know, 5-10 minutes like that. And when I was in Asia, I used to walk a lot. I would walk on alms round. I would walk 5 miles in one direction and then turn around and come back with 10 or 12 pounds of food, which is really heavy for 5 miles. Yeah. I had a bag. My food karma is really good. David went to Indonesia with me one time, and he saw what my food karma is like. I would sit down, and I was the only monk, and there would be 2 8-foot tables together, and you couldn't get any more on the table. And like I said, when I went out for alms round, I always came back with enough food for 5 people. Because I never refused food. Whatever somebody wanted to give me, that's what I got. The other monks liked that, so they didn't have to go out on an alms round so much. One time I was in Thailand, in Chiang Mai, and I went out for alms round on the king's birthday. And I walked out of the monastery about 20 feet, and I had so much food I couldn't carry it anymore. So I was turning around going back, and they started begging me, please, no, accept. So this guy went and got a big plastic bag. So they would put the food in the bowl, and I would just dump it in the bag. And then the bag filled up, so somebody else came around and brought a truck. And the truck was full of food. And when I went back into the monastery, fortunately, there was an orphanage there. And monks always get the best food, always the best. So I told the people running the orphanage, come and take this food. But there was also about 20 people that they had disabilities, the fingers and toes missing and things like that. So I gave them a couple bags of food. And that was kind of a fun day, but it was so much food that I was intimidated by it, and I wound up being hungry that night because I couldn't, it was too much food. But I had the opportunity to really help for a few days at the monastery to feed these other people. And that made me happy.
So, even when I was in Burma, I went up to Mae Mew, and Mae Mew is a very poor area. Sometimes they don't have enough food for themselves. But whatever food they had, they would rather go hungry than let the monk go hungry. So they were giving me their food. And I'd come back with enough for the five monks that were there. And the tradition is that when you get done, you just get rid of all of your food. And I wasn't about to throw that food away with these people that were so hungry. So I would put it on a big tray and carry it back into the village and put it down on somebody's doorstep, and anybody that wanted the food, they could take it. But there was one man that he was so poor, all he had was like three potato chips that he could give. So I made sure I ate those. I wanted him to make the merit. But sometimes there would be like one peanut. That's all they could afford. Burma has changed now. There's not quite so many poor people. But when I was in Rangoon, I started going out after the rains retreat. I started going out on alms round. And the way they do it in Burma is somebody will request that a monk come and come to their house and get some food. And the first couple of days I went to three houses and came back, no big deal. And then more and more people started asking that I come around. They asked me the monastery by my name, which I didn't know they knew. And I was going to 15 people, to 15 different houses. In the last house, this man was so generous. He gave me a papaya, you know, the big ones like that, every day. And thankfully, he was the last person I saw on the way back to the monastery, so I didn't have to carry it too far. But when I got back to the monastery, I just gave them all the food. They could do whatever they wanted with it, and then we would eat. But one of the things that you're supposed to do when you go out on alms round is radiate loving kindness. And they really look forward to my coming around and radiating loving kindness, and they wanted to feed me as much as they possibly could. It's interesting. No, that's it. Yeah. That's not a small thing. You know, people that die, somebody in the family is always feeling like they're helpless, they don't know what to do, they don't know what to say. So I've been teaching a lot of people that are in that kind of situation to start radiating loving kindness not only to the person that's dying, but to all of the family members and the doctors and the nurses that are taking care of them and things like that. And you don't feel helpless then. You feel like you're doing something that's really worthwhile, and you are. So you don't get so caught up in the emotional grief because you knew that you helped them when you started radiating loving kindness to them. And quite often the people that died would die very peacefully. So why don't we share some merit? May suffering ones be suffering free, and the fear-struck fearless be. May the grieving shed all grief, and may all beings find relief. May all beings share this merit that we have thus acquired for the acquisition of all kinds of happiness. May beings inhabiting space and earth, devas and nagas of mighty power, share this merit of ours. May they long protect the Buddha's dispensation. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.